All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Roundhouse Crosstalk, a podcast hosted by the California State Railroad Museum. In this week's episode, we're going to be talking about Hellbound Train, which is about the beginning of the Pennsylvania State Institutional System for people with intellectual disabilities. I'm sitting here with Elliot Simon, and you are the author of that article. So thank you for being here with us today.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
Let's go ahead and start with the title there. So Hellbound Train, okay. That's a pretty evocative title. How did we come up with that?
Yeah, well, I have an interest in music as well as being a psychologist and a historian of intellectual and developmental disabilities. So the image of a hellbound train is very powerful, as you said. And the hellbound train has been in music and literature in a variety of ways. The song that I chose to kind of intro this was one by Savoy Brown Blues Band, and the paper opens with a quote from that that speaks to the idea of, you know, being on this train forever that's going to hell. And people who know or look into the history of the institutional system for intellectual disability, one could characterize it as hellish in many ways. So the title came about at that, and kind of the structure of the paper was I structured it around, you know, hear the whistle blowing, which was kind of the forward winds of, you know, the winds that are saying that this is going to happen. And then, you know, all aboard being the logistics of getting this thing ready to roll. And the passengers, I spoke about them in depth, who were the people who were taken from Elwyn outside of Philadelphia to Polk. So it was really the evocative imagery. And the other piece of it is that once this thing got started, once the institutional system got started, not only in Pennsylvania, but then the rest of the country, it couldn't be stopped. You know, so it really was a train running down the tracks that kind of self-fulfilled itself and couldn't be stopped until some major lawsuits and issues really in the 1960s.
Yeah, and that's sort of interesting. So we've done a couple episodes about the railroad's involvement in music and as like, sure, this metaphor for things like that, like systems that can't be stopped and things like that. But I think when we had seen it previously used as like an afterlife metaphor, it had been the exact inverse, where it's the train to take you to the afterlife, and it's like supposed to be this sort of nice-ish thing. So it's interesting to see that kind of inverted here, to talk about a hellbound train and then specifically to talk about it in relation to this system.
Yeah, there was a poem that was written called Hellbound Train way back in the 19th century that speaks to a person who was an alcoholic, and he had a dream and dreamt that he was on this hellbound train, and it was so horrible that when he woke up, he decided to kind of, you know, go straight and address his alcohol addiction. So
would you say that something similar happened here, where people woke up to the realization that they were on a hellbound train, you know, this intellectual disability system?
Yeah.
You know, the lawsuits in the 60s, would you say they woke up from that and changed their ways?
Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily the people who were conducting or running the train that woke up. They were woken up by parents and by outside forces that, when these were exposed, a famous one is Willowbrook in New York, another one is Pennhurst in Pennsylvania, Polk itself had its own scandals and issues that were in the paper. So with that and other movements, the system was shaken, and the system still exists. I mean, there's still, you know, state institutions for people with intellectual disability, but the system was woken up by outside forces.
Something I find sort of interesting here is not only is the hellbound train like used as a metaphor for the intellectual disability system in this era, but the events that we're talking about and the school that we're talking about only exist
because of the train, or at least maybe a better way of phrasing that is the way that they do exist is because of the railroad, the specific location, as well as some of the individuals that we're going to be talking about. They got to the institution via the railroad. So for our listeners who are mostly based in California, can you go over a little bit of the railroad history in Pennsylvania and how that led to the institution taking the shape that it did?
Sure. Railroad in Pennsylvania is kind of synonymous. I mean, it's a major hub and beginnings of railroad service in the country. So Elwyn, which is where these individuals were living, was right outside Philadelphia, and the Pennsylvania Railroad Company, a famous railroad, certainly, already had a route from Philadelphia out to the western part of Philadelphia, which is now the western Philadelphia suburbs. That train route is still going. SEPTA still operates from Philadelphia west. They actually just added a station onto that further west. So Elwyn, for many, many years, was the end of it. So it was called the Media Elwyn train line. And I worked at Elwyn for many years. So having that train there was great for staff to come in from Philadelphia, for clients who live there to be able to access the train and use it and to go into Philadelphia. Elwyn started in 1852 in Philadelphia, and they soon, in 1857, they broke ground for something west of Philadelphia to be a campus setting. And one of the reasons they chose it there was because of the Elwyn Station, which was already there and was called Greenwood Station at the time. So the train, at that time, when Elwyn was moved there in 1859, went another stop past Elwyn, and eventually the train went all the way to Westchester, Pennsylvania, which is further west and up the line. So one of the reasons Elwyn is where it is there were farmlands along this railroad, and there was a stop put there, for this. Polk has a different railroad history in that. Polk is in kind of northwestern Pennsylvania, and it's very close to Oil City. I don't know if you're familiar with Oil City or not, but Oil City, Pennsylvania is the first oil well in the United States. So Pennsylvania has a huge, rich oil history, which not a lot of people realize. So things like Quaker State Oil, Pennzoil, all those things are from Pennsylvania originally. So one of the things that had to happen because of the oil industry was trains, because they had to get the oil from Oil City and the surrounding areas in Franklin County, Pennsylvania, up to Lake Erie and other places. So when they struck oil in Pennsylvania and they started to drill for it in vast numbers, that area became very rich. And this is before Polk started. This is before 1897. So by the time they were trying to figure out where to put Polk, there had been a booming oil industry there with train lines. So trains like the small local trains started out, like Franklin and Clearfield Railroad, and it would hook up with the Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railroad, which went up to the Great Lakes. And there were things like Oil Creek Railroad, so these small railroads that were eventually all bought up pretty much by Pennsylvania Railroad at some point. But there was a network already there. The other kind of connection with the railroads up there was there's oil there. A guy in Franklin, Pennsylvania, figured out that if you mix galena, which is an ore that is mined not in Pennsylvania but in other places in the country, Illinois, other places, if you mix that with the oil, it made a fantastic lubricant. So that lubricant was used in almost every single railroad in the country. So this Galena Oil Company, which was eventually bought up by us by Rockefeller and Standard Oil, was important in allowing the railroads to run efficiently. It had a tremendous lubricant property that lasted forever, kind of thing. So you had that area with a lot of money. You had it as a railroad crossroad. There was a Polk Junction where a couple of these railroads met. And it was decided for that reason, rich water source around there, to put the first institution like this in Pennsylvania there at Polk. It also had to be in the West because Elwin was already in the East. And as far as this goes for an Eastern state, Pennsylvania was late to the state institution world because they already had Elwin, which was serving the whole state. It became overcrowded. It was decided they needed something in the West. And the state by that time was being pressured to get into the business of institution.
And when did many of the other states get started with this? Was this sort of, if I remember correctly, it was sort of like after the Civil War?
After the Civil War, it started to really take off. The first institution in the United States like this was at a school for the deaf in Boston, Perkins School for the Deaf, started by Samuel Gridley Howe in the 1840s, 1848. And after that one, there was one in New York, a couple of others in Massachusetts, then Elwin was like the third or the fourth, depending on how you want to count these. What they started out as was not institutions like we think of them as snake pits. What they started out as were schools with the idea of education.
So they picked the spot for this school based on sort of the railroad tracks and sort of easy transportation to that school. And your article follows a specific train that left on April 20th in 1897. And it talks about sort of the intellectual disability system from that 1897, late 1800s to the mid-1900s, as we're talking about in the 60s, where things start to change. Can you walk our audience through what that system looked like during this time period and what the asylum village concept was all about?
Sure. When these schools, which turned into institutions, began, they were started by very forward-thinking people, Samuel Gridley Howe being one, Massachusetts. And the idea was to educate people with intellectual disability, which during that time was called idiocy. Okay. The term has become pejorative, as has mental retardation, which is a term that became popular to describe these conditions for many years, but we now call them intellectual disability is the current name for them. And this idea of idiocy and feeble-mindedness, up until some work that was done in France by Edward Séguin, it was thought that it was unable to be addressed educationally. So along these times, and I'm going like back into the 1830s, people who were deaf were being taught to speak, the blind were being taught to see through, Braille and early systems. So people with intellectual disability, it was felt, should be addressed to. So Séguin was the first really to do this in any real circumscribed way with a curriculum in France. People in Massachusetts became aware of that. They started a school there. They went to study with Séguin. James Richard opened that school as the first teacher under Samuel Gridley Howe. Gridley Howe was very anti-congregate institutional care. And a lot of the quotes in the article from Howe speak to that. What happened was that Howe's model was not working as well as people had hoped. Part of the reason was it was a school, so people were funded there until the age of 16. After the age of 16, the idea was they would be educated and they would go back to their families, communities, and be solid citizens. While that happened for some, it didn't happen for all. So the question became, what do you do with the people who are adults that you weren't receiving any money for? Turn them out into the streets? One idea was, well, if they're, quote, incurable, they should be in the mental health system, not in the intellectual disability system. In Pennsylvania, when Elwin opened up as the first school in Pennsylvania to do this, they actually hired Richards from Massachusetts to be the first teacher at Elwin. And he went about doing a similar thing that he was doing in Massachusetts, trying to educate people with intellectual disability. When Elwin started, they made an agreement with Harrisburg that they would take care of, educate, address every person with intellectual disability in Pennsylvania, which was, you know, a ridiculous thing to propose, but they did that. So Elwin was stuck with, when the people turned 16 and the funding wasn't there, they couldn't turn them out into the street. They could, you know, they said, so this idea of what do you do with people who at that time were felt couldn't be educated, the lack of funding. A lot of times, even if people were educated, there was no place for them to go in the community. There were no community services at all. The families and sometimes didn't want the people back. So you had this problem that a guy by the name of Isaac Curlin at Elwin solved with a model called the Asylum Village. That model is essentially a self-contained community where people who with intellectual disability who are more able are trained to be workers, unpaid, at the institution, as well as trained to take care of those who could not take care of themselves. So you had a closed community where that model succeeded from the standpoint of being fiscally responsible, according to the people who were running things, as well as it took care of a problem, because by this time, people with intellectual disability were felt to be a menace to society because of eugenics becoming popular in the United States. So they were viewed as having bad seed, and they should not be part of society. So these places that started out as being forward-thinking schools turned into places to sequester and segregate people from society.
You talked about in the article how is one of them critiquing that model. What did people at the time have to say on why this wasn't the correct thing to do?
Well, the main person who was antagonistic toward the model was still Samuel Gridley Howe. And he was very well respected as a person for a variety of reasons. I mean, he was well known. He started Perkins School for the Blind. He was the first person documented to teach a person who was blind and deaf to communicate. Laura Bridgman, Helen Keller's teacher actually was trained at Perkins, Andy Sullivan, this is before that. But he felt that the congregation of, you know, people in congregate care was not the way to do it, that the field should be an educational field, as Richards felt that as well. And the institutional model really didn't take off until 1876. Post-Civil War, there were some institutions, certainly, but there was this idea of what should the field be? Should it be an education field? Should it be a medical field? You know, which model should it have? And the medical model at that point won out. So the medical model is you diagnose and you treat. This field, when Gridley Howe died, was taken over really by, now Gridley Howe was a doctor, but he was a doctor, but he didn't want to be a doctor. And Richards was a teacher. So, but in 1876, Curlin was a doctor, essentially took over the field, started a society at Elwin, and it just so happens that in 1876, Samuel Gridley Howe died. So from 1876 through the 1960s, there was not a lot of outcry about this model because the public really was relatively unaware of this kind of thing. There were issues, certainly. There were people who said there's got to be a better way, family living, community living, but it really didn't kick off until the country was woken up by exposés at Pennhurst and Willowbrook.
Well, and it sounds like, right, like unless you have a personal connection, a reason to know about these institutions and what they look like on the inside, if like they're being removed from, you know, the standard community in which they would have been born into. They might not have known the extent to which.
They didn't know, they didn't want to know. They had no reason necessarily for themselves to know. I mean, I've spoken to people who lived, they could see Elwin and they took the train from Elwin to go into Philadelphia. They really didn't know what Elwin did. You know, they kind of never been there. You know, it's a large campus, it's 600 acres. at one point, and it was kind of a hospital, an institution, whatever. They didn't think much of it.
So when we're talking about that train trip, that hellbound train that took these, I think it was 120 passengers.
153 residents plus six staff from Elwin, from Polk, and a staff doctor from Elwin, as well as the train personnel, you know, the engineer, the conductor, whatever.
Gotcha. So can you walk us through, your article talks a little bit about what the experience was like to get folks to the school. And then can you talk a little bit about like what demographic conditions might lead somebody to be on the train?
Sure. At this point, there were, you know, several hundreds of people living at Elwin, and 150 some of them were not from what they call the Eastern Pennsylvania counties, which are east of Harrisburg. Certain percentage was from the west. So the state had to get into the institution business, and it was decided, since Elwin was in the east, that they would have an institution in the west. So basically a law was passed that said anybody who was being funded by any of these counties west of Harrisburg are going to be taken out of Elwin and moved to Polk. So that was the criteria. And as I go through some of those people's records, a lot of them today would not be diagnosed with intellectual disability. People came to Elwin for a variety of reasons, but they were just under this system because there really was no other system. So the criteria was they lived at Elwin and they were from the western part of the state. A younger population, because people came there as children, really, a lot of them, to go to school, you know, or to go to Elwin for that reason.
And then sort of what was that train trip experience like? You talked about being sort of logistical nightmare, and some people were sort of fighting over who should have the sort of power over what those.
Yeah. Are. And that's a typical, you know, administrative bureaucratic, who's going to be in control of this. By this time, Curlin was out of the picture. He had passed away, and Martin Barr became superintendent of Elwin, and Murdoch was assigned to be superintendent at Polk. So the two of them kind of were vying for who should honcho this. And Barr had the people, so he had a lot of clout, but Murdoch was the state person, so he was the state, you know. So they kind of went back and forth, but eventually they figured out what to do. And Barr, basically his idea was, the individuals on that train are Barr's responsibility until they reach Pittsburgh and then go to Polk. So it was agreed that kind of the doctor from Elwin would kind of honcho the train ride as far as being in charge of the people on the train. They actually, I believe, added a car to the train. Some of these individuals who went west to Polk were infirm or had some illness, so they added a car where they could sleep on it. And 153 people boarded that train. The train started in Elwin, right at the Elwin station, that's still there, went to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, then went up to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. There, the line continued to Altoona, Johnstown, which were major stops on the railroad at the time. And their first stop really was in Pittsburgh. So that's a heck of a journey. I mean, it took them overnight, you know, a while to get there, to go from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. It's all the way across the side of the state. Then they had a big layover in Pittsburgh, and there was an issue of what to do. And Barr wrote that children should have a hot meal when they get to Pittsburgh, or coffee or something, because they hadn't really eaten anything hot from the prior day before. So they stayed in Pittsburgh, and then they went up to, you know, Polk Junction there, which is the junction of the railroads, and they were at Polk, and you know, it was supervised by staff. The children were, as far as I know, well behaved. There was no telephone. There was none of this was going on. So a telegram was sent to Barr. And Elwin has kept all these papers in their archives, which is just a tremendous, you know, cache of historical information. And without their cooperation, this paper and a lot of other things I've done would never have happened. So, but they, a telegram was sent from Murdoch to Barr, said the children arrived safely, thank you very much, kind of thing. And at that point, Barr kind of went around about his business, and Polk began its long history.
And sort of when folks were onboarding that train, do we have any records of what that, like, were they afraid to go on the train? Did they sort of understand? I mean, we're talking about it as a hellbound train, but I wonder what that thinking process was.
Yeah. For the people on the train, as far as I can tell, and I have nothing real specific of a person who lived there saying what they felt about it. They were told, you're going home. You're going to where you're from. They're all from the western part of the state. Those that had families out there, some of those families were pleased that they were going to be closer to home. And so it was viewed as a train ride. And they had been, you know, some of these individuals had been on trains before. Because Elwin did take trips, different places, you know. So it was viewed probably as nice, you know, a nice trip to go to the western part of the state, to go to Polk, to go to Pittsburgh. So I would say nobody on that train, including the staff, realized where that train was going and where it was taking the system.
Okay, so they arrive at the institution. So one thing it's sort of specific. In the article, you mentioned that the average age of death of individuals at the institution was about 41 years old. Mm-hmm. Do you view that as sort of typical for the time period, conditions, and all of that? Or is that lower than we'd expect with better circumstances, I guess?
It's very much in line with what was going on at that time, for a large variety of reasons. Medical advances really weren't happening yet that would prolong the life of people. People with Down syndrome, for instance, make up, you know, a fair percentage of people with intellectual disability. At that time, they didn't typically live. They lived into their 30s. It was, you know, a big accomplishment. Today, with a lot of procedures and medical care, people with Down syndrome have a heart defect sometimes, and that would end their life quickly. You know, so today people with Down syndrome can live into their 60s. And the other thing was that some of the people who had severe physical disabilities just didn't get there. It wasn't, the care wasn't around. Support wasn't around for them to. You know, if somebody then got pneumonia, who couldn't really move very well, it was a lot of times a death sentence.
So then these passengers, when they arrive at the institution, you also mentioned that some escaped, and it just seems like, I guess, how common was it for individuals to sort of not have a great experience there, try to run away, that sort of thing?
It was fairly common. And even at Elwin, it was common before people got to Polk. So again, you got to realize that during this time period, there were many, many people who lived at Elwin and at Polk who today would not be diagnosed with intellectual disability. So people who were very intellectually able, and they eventually wanted to leave and go into society, get married and have kids, you know, all these things. That they wanted to do that they couldn't do in the institution. So a lot of them left. I mean, Elwin itself during the World Wars had individuals who enlisted, you know, who got into the armed forces, Polk the same way. I mean, it was very, very different. The people who were went to Polk and were living there. And that goes back to Curlin's model, because you need those people. You need high functioning, quote, people to be trained to be the masons, the plumbers, the the groundsmen, the direct care workers. I mean, 80% of the women who were admitted to Elwyn were trained to be direct care, to take care of individuals who could not, you know, do their self-care skills. So Curlin's model worked. If somebody were to ask Curlin today, what happened to your model? Why were there all these, you know, horror shows of Polk was in the news for having people in cages and Pennhurst with tremendously understaffed and 80 people, you know, living in a room with two staff, children living there who didn't learn to walk because they couldn't be let out of their cribs to learn how to walk because of understaffing and abuse and horrible things going on that were brought to light. Curlin would probably say, well, you didn't keep the right mix. Mm-hmm. The people who were able to be trained were not there anymore. And the numbers of people who, you know, were more difficult to train increased. And one of the reasons that happened was because of the increase in medical care. So you had a large increase in people with severe and profound intellectual disability who were being put in these institutions, and that percentage started to shift, and the staffing didn't increase, and a lot of different things happened that turned it into a horror show. You know, it turned it into hell.
And I think your article talks about, and it might have been a passenger on the original train. I'm trying to remember, but she came to the institution as a child, and eventually went into direct care. And then I think she like stayed there until she was in her 80s or 90s before, but essentially her whole life.
This was a lifetime sentence in most cases. Some people did leave. Some people went back to their families. Some people, as you mentioned, eloped. And there was a big problem with eloping. At Elwyn and at Polk, but it wasn't uncommon for that to happen. And these people were valued. I mean, and the institutions touted how much money they saved by working there. And it was again touted as this is therapy. This is their therapy to learn a trade and to maintain the institution.
Yeah. Okay, so I found I got a couple things stories mixed up, but it was John M, who looks like he was photographed tossing the first tip at a local basketball tournament, was 97 when he was finally discharged. So and that was, I'm sure, like a sort of discharge because sort of can't care for him anymore kind of thing.
No, he was discharged, and believe it or not, John M's records are still protected by HIPAA. Huh. And so I could not speak to what happened to John M after he left. Everything else I spoke about is in the public record. So John's clinical files are still protected by HIPAA. But you know, he is the longest living person who was on that train. And as you can see from looking at his life, very high functioning person, able. He lived out his life and eventually made it out at the age of 97.
Yeah. I just think that's amazing. We're talking about eventually passing away in 1989, you know? So like, yeah. This thing that we're thinking of all the way back in the 1800s, I mean, like, its legacy continues so much further with these folks. One of the things you mentioned is that some people were in this institution that today would not be recognized as intellectually disabled. How would that sort of happen? What would make somebody that we wouldn't classify today as be classified then?
Yeah. A variety of things. One of them was IQ tests had not been invented yet. So intellectual disability, which today you diagnose with a certain IQ number, 70 or less approximately, deficits in adaptive behavior, both of which occur during the developmental period. That's the current diagnosis. Back then, it was a clinical diagnosis. There was no measurement like that. And Curlin invented the diagnostic system that was in use. So what he did, very clever in his own way, but really horrible, was he said, intellectual disability and epilepsy are the same bad seed. They're caused by the same poor genetics. So it's really the same thing. And those individuals should also be out of society and in these institutions, in my asylum village. So what did that give him? It gave him people without intellectual disability who had seizure disorder who he could train. Okay. So those people got in. And a lot of these places were called for idiocy, feeble-mindedness, and epileptic, it was in the title as well. So you had people with seizure disorders who were placed in institutions just because they had a seizure disorder. The other thing, if you look at people from Elwyn and some of those records that I looked through, both parents had died, the mother died, the father couldn't care for the people because he had to work. So there were people like that who were placed at Elwyn and other places like this. The other thing that Curlin came up with, in addition to epilepsy, was a diagnostic category that is, not valid, but he called this the moral imbecile. So what is a moral imbecile, according to Curlin? Today, you might call them, adjudicated youth or youth who are involved in criminal enterprises. So those moral imbeciles, guess what? They were part of the same kind of spectrum of genetically poor individuals, whatever. So moral imbeciles also should be in the institution. So what did that get? It gave him quite intellectually able people who had, behavioral problems, criminal records, who came to the institution and were able to be, in Curlin's mind, trained and made, solid members of the institution society. I mean, when I first came to Elwyn in the 1980s, there were many people there still like that. I remember one gentleman who he built most of the stone walls all around Elwyn. He was a really trained mason. So there were a lot of different people like that. In the 1980s, even Elwyn had driver's education for the people who lived there. So it's very different as far as the composition of these institutions. And in order for them to work according to Curlin's asylum village model, you need it.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like a lot of that. So it is sort of creating a separate gene pool. It sounds like it's mostly like based on eugenics reasons on why individuals.
Well, that's part of the reason. Yeah. I mean, eugenics certainly promoted getting these people out of society because they were bad seed, and there was a major fear that they would take over the gene pool in the United States because they would do surveys and they would come up with an increasing number of people with intellectual disability every year. And then certain eugenicists started to claim that in certain ethnic groups, there was a higher incidence of intellectual disability. So there was something called the Kallikak study that was published at a Vineland institution in New Jersey and by Goddard. And Goddard is the person actually who did the first mental measurement in the United States. So Goddard is the person who kind of took away Curlin's diagnostic system and made what is really almost the diagnostic system we have today. He didn't call it IQ. He needed people from Stanford to come in and do the real, mathematical stuff to get the IQ. So, which is why it's called the Stanford-Binet, the IQ test. But then it turned into IQ tests. So he measured at Ellis Island, Goddard measured immigrants coming in. And guess what? He found a larger proportion of immigrants had IQs or mental ages in the range of intellectual disability. So this society was running scared. They were running scared of this.
Yeah. And so is that reflected at all, that sort of like, sort of racist idea of like certain population groups having like a higher proportion of the intellectual disabilities. Was that reflected in this school at all?
In Polk?
Yeah. Or,
well, that had just really started, you know, so the eugenics movement had just kind of started a few years before and really didn't get rolling until a little bit later. So I from my looking at records, I would say no. Most of the people were from Pennsylvania. Some of them certainly were from immigrants whose parents were working in coal mines and things like that, that they came to Pennsylvania to do work from Eastern Europe. So of course it was the Eastern Europe population that was felt to have intellectual disability, you know, at a higher rate than the others, because that's where the immigrants were coming from in the late 19th century. You know, so it was all kind of, you know, sewn together in a beautiful, a beautiful, horrible way to get these people out of society and meet, you know, certain people's ideas of what of who should be in society and who shouldn't.
For sure. And so what do you see as the legacy for the South institution? Like, obviously you mentioned in the 60s, you know, it's a big reveal of sort of what these institutions look like, and we start to see some changes. I guess, to what extent is the school's legacy still there, and how it was operated? And to what extent is it different today, I guess?
Well, many more people are still supported in the community now than in institutions. Institutions are still open in many states. Pennsylvania has an institution that's open. Polk itself was closed in April of 2023. So the last person left Polk in April of last year. Okay, so you know its legacy is that it was closed less than a year ago. There are others still operating. Do they operate on this Curlin model? No, because peonage laws came in and staff had to be hired and all sorts of things changed that. The main thing that you know, aside from the lawsuits and the exposés, that changed the system to a community-based system, and that change is still going on today. It was certain federal laws that allowed the federal government to offset the state money. So prior to, you know, the 1970s, there was no federal money for any of this. So the states had to do it on their own dime. And when the federal money stepped in, which really was on the heels of the exposés, then the staffing was increased, et cetera. And the community started really a little later with federal money. Excuse me.
Awesome.
But they're still open. There's institutions still open for intellectual disability, state-run institutions. Most of them have closed, but some states still have large institutional populations compared to others.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you mentioned that, I mean, the Erwin School only shut down, you know, April of last year. Yeah. Was that just because...
Polk shut down.
Was that just because the last sort of person was no longer needing care there?
Well, the state stopped admissions. The state plan is to get out of having institutions and to have all community service. Elwin is still there as part of it as a campus setting still. So there are still people with intellectual disability living at Elwin. And most of Elwin's supports are in the community, but there's still some in a congregate setting on a campus.
One of the main reasons we originally were so interested in sort of reading the article and eventually contacting you was how this connects to some other podcasts that we've done about the way you phrase it is forced mobility of undesirables, in quotes. And I think that's just a really interesting sort of development with the railroad. You know, the state now has this power to move people across vast distances and spaces and regulate essentially with that power who makes up the community. And I think this sort of fits in line with that general process that we're seeing. And it's all around the same time period. We did a podcast on deportation trains, and those get started in the late 1800s as well. But can you walk us through how the expansion of railroad in this instance helped pave the path for that expansion of government power? And I guess just kind of compare what people did before the railroad, you know, now we're going back to a community-based model. Was that sort of what happened before the railroad was there, probably in a less formal way?
Yeah, I mean, before the railroad, which is obviously in the same time period as industrialization, industrial revolution in the United States, you know, I mean, that really affected people with intellectual disability, because prior to that, there was things for them to do. And in a lot of cases, they didn't live all that long. People with severe physical handicaps did not live, you know, that long. So the community and the family system, you know, supported them. But it was this idea, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And this train started with the good intentions of, wow, this will be great. We can educate folks who we couldn't educate before. And it was all tied in really into the abolitionist movement and transcendental, you know, thoughts in Boston and the transcendentalists up there. So it started out as a forward-thinking way to educate people and have them come into society and be, you know, solid citizens. It clearly went wrong. So the railroad, you know, it enabled institutions to be kind of out. You know, Polk is rural. There's not a lot of people there, which was perfect for them. When Elwin moved out to Elwin from Philadelphia, it was all farmland. You know, so how are you going to get people there? The only way to do that is by having a transportation system, and the only transportation system was the rail. So the other thing that I think you alluded to is what's sometimes called the orphan train movement, where this was a welfare program in New York City and other big Eastern cities, where the train transported children who, not all of which, in fact, most of which were not orphans. They were children of immigrants, big families, couldn't support the child. They were out on the streets. They were taken out of New York and other places and sent to, you know, places like Indiana and, you know, farms. They worked on farms, and there was over like 200,000 children, you know, put on trains and taken out of Eastern cities, again, with good intention. But today the morality is that you don't do that for good reason. So the trains enabled, as you said, the wholesale movement of people from one place to what, when these started, were thought to be better environments and were forward thinking.
Yeah, and I mean, going back to what we said earlier, the fact that it is, you know, removing these people to farmland, this area outside the city, sort of, it sounds like, helps people turn a blind eye to the things that are happening. Mm-hmm. That may not have been the original intention, but that was certainly sort of the effect eventually.
Yeah, I think it wasn't the original intention. It became part of the intention because of the eugenics, out of society, get them out of sight, out of mind. And that promoted the growth of the institutional system. So in a lot of places like we're talking about, in many, many states, the system, you know, started out as training people and children to be back in society. And it ended up training children and adults to keep them out of society, you know, with the idea to keep them out. And that switched, you know, in the 60s. So, the trains, without the trains, you wouldn't have supplies. How did you get them? I mean, you know, it's very important to be at a hub. Now, before Polk Center was built, nobody in Pennsylvania necessarily heard of Polk, Pennsylvania, except people in the railroad who knew there was a junction there, right? I mean, that that's what it was, you know. And when the oil was drilled there, and it became at one point in that part of Pennsylvania, there were more millionaires per square mile than anywhere else in the country. So you had Vanderbilt and Rockefeller working together to get the oil with Standard Oil and to transport it with Vanderbilt on the railroad. So those two were working in league, to do this. And this institutional system took big advantage of that.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on this this morning. And
thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Roundhouse Crosstalk, a podcast hosted by the California State Railroad Museum. And we'll see you next time.